Chapter 7. Now This. The American humorist H. Allen Smith once suggested that of all the worrisome words in the English language, the scariest is uh-oh, as when a physician looks at your x-rays and with knitted brow says, uh-oh. I should like to suggest that the words which are the title of this chapter are as ominous as any, all the more so because they are spoken without knitted brow, indeed with a kind of idiot's delight. The phrase, if that's what it may be called, adds to our grammar a new part of speech, a conjunction that does not connect anything to anything, but does the opposite, separates everything from everything. As such, it serves as a compact metaphor for the discontinuities in so much that passes for public discourse in present-day America. Now This is commonly used on radio and television newscasts to indicate that what one has just heard or seen has no relevance to what one is about to hear or see, or possibly to anything one is ever likely to hear or see. The phrase is a means of acknowledging the fact that the world as mapped by the speeded-up electronic media has no order or meaning and is not to be taken seriously. There is no murder so brutal, no earthquake so devastating, no political blunder so costly, for that matter, no ball score so tantalizing or weather report so threatening that it cannot be erased from our minds by a newscaster saying, "Now, this." The newscaster means that you have thought long enough on the previous matter, approximately 45 seconds, that you must not be morbidly preoccupied with it, let us say, for 90 seconds, and that you must now give your attention to another fragment of news or a commercial. Television did not invent the "now this" worldview. As I have tried to show, it is the offspring of the intercourse between telegraphy and photography. But it is through television that it has been nurtured and brought to a perverse maturity. For on television, nearly every half hour is a discrete event, separated in content, context, and emotional texture from what precedes and follows it. In part because television sells its time in seconds and minutes, in part because television must use images rather than words, in part because its audience can move freely to and from the television set, programs are structured so that almost each 8-minute segment may stand as a complete event in itself. Viewers are rarely required to carry over any thought or feeling from one parcel of time to another. Of course, in television's presentation of the news of the day, we may see the "now this" mode of discourse in its boldest and most embarrassing form, for there we are presented not only with fragmented news, but news without context, without consequences, without value, and therefore without essential seriousness, that is to say, news as pure entertainment. Consider, for example, how you would proceed if you were given the opportunity to produce a television news show for any station concerned to attract the largest possible audience. You would, first, choose a cast of players, each of whom has a face that is both likable and credible. Those who apply would, in fact, submit to you their 8x10 glossies, from which you would eliminate those whose countenances are not suitable for nightly display. This means that you will exclude women who are not beautiful or who are over the age of 50, men who are bald, all people who are overweight or whose noses are too long or whose eyes are too close together. You will try, in other words, to assemble a cast of talking hairdos. At the very least, you will want those whose faces would not be unwelcome on a magazine cover. Christine Kraft has just such a face, and so she applied for a co-anchor position on KMBC-TV in Kansas City. According to a lawyer who represented her in a sexism suit she later brought against the station, the management of KMBC-TV loved Christine's look. She was accordingly hired in January 1981. She was fired in August 1981 because research indicated that her appearance hampered viewer acceptance. What exactly does hampered viewer acceptance mean, and what does it have to do with the news? Hampered viewer acceptance means the same thing for television news as it does for any television show. Viewers do not like looking at the performer. It also means that viewers do not believe the performer, that she lacks credibility. In the case of a theatrical performance, we have a sense of what that implies. The actor does not persuade the audience that he or she is the character being portrayed. But what does lack of credibility imply in the case of a news show? What character is a co-anchor playing? And how do we decide that the performance lacks verisimilitude? Does the audience believe that the newscaster is lying, that what is reported did not in fact happen, that something important is being concealed? It is frightening to think that this may be so, that the perception of the truth of a report rests heavily on the acceptability of the newscaster. In the ancient world, there was a tradition of banishing or killing the bearer of bad tidings. Does the television news show restore, in a curious form, this tradition? Do we banish those who tell us the news when we do not care for the face of the teller? Does television countermand the warnings we once received about the fallacy of the ad hominem argument? If the answer to any of these questions is even a qualified yes, then here is an issue worthy of the attention of epistemologists. Stated in its simplest form, it is that television provides a new, or possibly restores an old, definition of truth. The credibility of the teller is the ultimate test of the truth of a proposition. Credibility here does not refer to the past record of the teller for making statements that have survived the rigors of reality testing. It refers only to the impression of sincerity, authenticity, vulnerability, or attractiveness, choose one or more, conveyed by the actor-reporter. This is a matter of considerable importance, for it goes beyond the question of how truth is perceived on television news shows. If on television credibility replaces reality as the decisive test of truth-telling, political leaders need not trouble themselves very much with reality, provided that their performances consistently generate a sense of verisimilitude. I suspect, for example, that the dishonor that now shrouds Richard Nixon results not from the fact that he lied, but that on television he looked like a liar. Which, if true, should bring no comfort to anyone, not even veteran Nixon haters. For the alternative possibilities are that one may look like a liar but be telling the truth, or even worse, look like a truth-teller but in fact be lying. As a producer of a television news show, you would be well aware of these matters and would be careful to choose your cast on the basis of criteria used by David Merrick and other successful impresarios. Like them, you would turn your attention to staging the show on principles that maximize entertainment value. You would, for example, select a musical theme for the show. All television news programs begin, end, and are somewhere in between punctuated with music. I have found very few Americans who regard this custom as peculiar, which in fact I have taken as evidence for the dissolution of lines of demarcation between serious public discourse and entertainment. What has music to do with the news? Why is it there? It is there, I assume, for the same reason music is used in the theater and films, to create a mood and provide a leitmotif for the entertainment. If there were no music, as is the case when any television program is interrupted for a news flash, viewers would expect something truly alarming, possibly life-altering. But as long as the music is there as a frame for the program, the viewer is comforted to believe that there is nothing to be greatly alarmed about, that in fact, the events that are reported have as much relation to reality as do scenes in a play. This perception of a news show as a stylized dramatic performance whose content has been staged largely to entertain is reinforced by several other features, including the fact that the average length of any story is 45 seconds. While brevity does not always suggest triviality, in this case it clearly does. It is simply not possible to convey a sense of seriousness about any event if its implications are exhausted in less than 1 minute's time. In fact, it is quite obvious that TV news has no intention of suggesting that any story has any implications, for that would require viewers to continue to think about it when it is done, and therefore obstruct their attending to the next story that waits panting in the wings. In any case, viewers are not provided with much opportunity to be distracted from the next story, since in all likelihood it will consist of some film footage. Pictures have little difficulty in overwhelming words and short-circuiting introspection. As a television producer, you would be certain to give both prominence and precedence to any event for which there is some sort of visual documentation. A suspected killer being brought into a police station, the angry face of a cheated consumer, a barrel going over Niagara Falls with a person alleged to be in it, the president disembarking from a helicopter on the White House lawn, these are always fascinating or amusing and easily satisfy the requirements of an entertaining show. It is, of course, not necessary that the visuals actually document the point of a story, neither is it necessary to explain why such images are intruding themselves on public consciousness. Film footage justifies itself, as every television producer well knows. It is also of considerable help in maintaining a high level of unreality that the newscasters do not pause to grimace or shiver when they speak their prefaces or epilogues to the film clips. Indeed, many newscasters do not appear to grasp the meaning of what they are saying, and some hold to a fixed and ingratiating enthusiasm as they report on earthquakes, mass killings, and other disasters. Viewers would be quite disconcerted by any show of concern or terror on the part of newscasters. Viewers, after all, are partners with the newscasters in the now-this culture, and they expect the newscaster to play out his or her role as a character who is marginally serious, but who stays well clear of authentic understanding. The viewers, for their part, will not be caught contaminating their responses with a sense of reality, any more than an audience at a play would go scurrying to call home because a character on stage has said that a murderer is loose in the neighborhood. The viewers also know that no matter how grave any fragment of news may appear, for example, on the day I write, a Marine Corps general has declared that nuclear war between the United States and Russia is inevitable, It will shortly be followed by a series of commercials that will, in an instant, defuse the import of the news, in fact, render it largely banal. This is a key element in the structure of a news program, and all by itself refutes any claim that television news is designed as a serious form of public discourse. Imagine what you would think of me and this book if I were to pause here, tell you that I will return to my discussion in a moment, and then proceed to write a few words in behalf of United Airlines or the Chase Manhattan Bank. You would rightly think that I had no respect for you, and certainly no respect for the subject. And if I did this not once, but several times in each chapter, you would think the whole enterprise unworthy of your attention. Why, then, do we not think a news show similarly unworthy? The reason, I believe, is that whereas we expect books and even other media, such as film, to maintain a consistency of tone and a continuity of content, we have no such expectation of television, and especially television news. We have become so accustomed to its discontinuities that we are no longer struck dumb, as any sane person would be, by a newscaster who, having just reported that a nuclear war is inevitable, goes on to say that he will be right back after this word from Burger King, who says, in other words, now this. One can hardly overestimate the damage that such juxtapositions do to our sense of the world as a serious place. The damage is especially massive to youthful viewers who depend so much on television for their clues as to how to respond to the world. In watching television news, they, more than any other segment of the audience, are drawn into an epistemology based on the assumption that all reports of cruelty and death are greatly exaggerated and, in any case, not to be taken seriously or responded to sanely. I should go so far as to say that embedded in the surrealistic frame of a television news show is a theory of anti-communication, featuring a type of discourse that abandons logic, reason, sequence, and rules of contradiction. In aesthetics, I believe the name given to this theory is Dadaism. In philosophy, nihilism. In psychiatry, schizophrenia. In the parlance of the theater, it is known as vaudeville. For those who think I am here guilty of hyperbole, I offer the following description of television news by Robert McNeil, executive editor and co-anchor of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. The idea, he writes, is to keep everything brief, not to strain the attention of anyone, but instead to provide constant stimulation through variety, novelty, action, and movement. You are required to pay attention to no concept, no character, and no problem for more than a few seconds at a time. He goes on to say that the assumptions controlling a news show are that bite-sized is best, that complexity must be avoided, that nuances are dispensable, that qualifications impede the simple message, that visual stimulation is a substitute for thought, and that verbal precision is an anachronism. Robert McNeil has more reason than most to give testimony about the television news show as vaudeville act. The McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour is an unusual and gracious attempt to bring to television some of the elements of typographic discourse. The program abjures visual stimulation, consists largely of extended explanations of events and in-depth interviews, which even there means only 5 to 10 minutes, limits the number of stories covered, and emphasizes background and coherence. But television has exacted its price for McNeil's rejection of a show business format. By television standards, the audience is minuscule. The program is confined to public television stations, and it is a good guess that the combined salary of McNeil and Lehrer is 1/5 of Dan Rather's or Tom Brokaw's. If you were a producer of a television news show for a commercial station, you would not have the option of defying television's requirements. It would be demanded of you that you strive for the largest possible audience, and as a consequence, and in spite of your best intentions, you would arrive at a production very nearly resembling McNeil's description. Moreover, you would include some things McNeil does not mention. You would try to make celebrities of your newscasters. You would advertise the show, both in the press and on television itself. You would do news briefs to serve as an inducement to viewers. You would have a weatherman as comic relief and a sportscaster whose language is a touch uncouth as a way of his relating to the beer-drinking common man. You would, in short, package the whole event as any producer might who is in the entertainment business. The result of all this is that Americans are the best entertained and quite likely the least well-informed people in the Western world. I say this in the face of the popular conceit that television, as a window to the world, has made Americans exceedingly well informed. Much depends here, of course, on what is meant by being informed. I will pass over the now tiresome polls that tell us that, at any given moment, 70% of our citizens do not know who is the Secretary of State or the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Let us consider instead the case of Iran during the drama that was called the Iranian hostage crisis. I don't suppose there has been a story in years that received more continuous attention from television. We may assume, then, that Americans know most of what there is to know about this unhappy event. And now I put these questions to you. Would it be an exaggeration to say that not one American in 100 knows what language the Iranians speak, or what the word Ayatollah means or implies, or knows any details of the tenets of Iranian religious beliefs, or the main outlines of their political history, or knows who the Shah was and where he came from? Nonetheless, everyone had an opinion about this event, for in America everyone is entitled to an opinion, and it is certainly useful to have a few when a pollster shows up. But these are opinions of a quite different order from 18th or 19th century opinions. It is probably more accurate to call them emotions rather than opinions, which would account for the fact that they change from week to week, as the pollsters tell us. What is happening here is that television is altering the meaning of being informed by creating a species of information that might properly be called disinformation. I am using this word almost in the precise sense in which it is used by spies in the CIA or KGB. Disinformation does not mean false information, it means misleading information, misplaced, irrelevant, fragmented, or superficial information, information that creates the illusion of knowing something, but which in fact leads one away from knowing. In saying this, I do not mean to imply that television news deliberately aims to deprive Americans of a coherent, contextual understanding of their world. I mean to say that when news is packaged as entertainment, that is the inevitable result. And in saying that the television news show entertains but does not inform, I am saying something far more serious than that we are being deprived of authentic information. I am saying we are losing our sense of what it means to be well informed. Ignorance is always correctable, but what shall we do if we take ignorance to be knowledge? Here is a startling example of how this process bedevils us. A New York Times article is headlined on February 15, 1983, "Reagan Misstatements Getting Less Attention." The article begins in the following way. President Reagan's aides used to become visibly alarmed at suggestions that he had given mangled and perhaps misleading accounts of his policies or of current events in general. That doesn't seem to happen much anymore. Indeed, the president continues to make debatable assertions of fact, but news accounts do not deal with them as extensively as they once did. In the view of White House officials, the declining news coverage mirrors a decline in interest by the general public. My italics. This report is not so much a news story as a story about the news, and our recent history suggests that it is not about Ronald Reagan's charm. It is about how news is defined, and I believe the story would be quite astonishing to both civil libertarians and tyrants of an earlier time. Walter Lippmann, for example, wrote in 1920, "There can be no liberty for a community which lacks the means by which to detect lies." For all of his pessimism about the possibilities of restoring an 18th and 19th century level of public discourse, Lippmann assumed, as did Thomas Jefferson before him, that with a well-trained press functioning as a lie detector, the public's interest in a president's mangling of the truth would be piqued in both senses of that word. Given the means to detect lies, he believed, the public could not be indifferent to their consequences. But this case refutes his assumption. The reporters who cover the White House are ready and able to expose lies, and thus create the grounds for informed and indignant opinion. But apparently the public declines to take an interest. To press reports of White House dissembling, the public has replied with Queen Victoria's famous line, "We are not amused." However, here the words mean something the Queen did not have in mind. They mean that what is not amusing does not compel their attention. Perhaps if the president's lies could be demonstrated by pictures and accompanied by music, the public would raise a curious eyebrow. If a movie like All the President's Men could be made from his misleading accounts of government policy, if there were a break-in of some sort or sinister characters laundering money, attention would quite likely be paid. We do well to remember that President Nixon did not begin to come undone until his lies were given a theatrical setting at the Watergate hearings. But we do not have anything like that here. Apparently, all President Reagan does is say things that are not entirely true, and there is nothing entertaining in that. But there is a subtler point to be made here. Many of the president's misstatements fall in the category of contradictions, mutually exclusive assertions that cannot possibly both in the same context be true. In the same context is the key phrase here, for it is context that defines contradiction. There is no problem in someone's remarking that he prefers oranges to apples, and also remarking that he prefers apples to oranges, not if one statement is made in the context of choosing a wallpaper design and the other in the context of selecting fruit for dessert. In such a case, we have statements that are opposites, but not contradictory. But if the statements are made in a single, continuous, and coherent context, then they are contradictions, and cannot both be true. Contradiction, in short, requires that statements and events be perceived as interrelated aspects of a continuous and coherent context. Disappear the context, or fragment it, and contradiction disappears. This point is nowhere made more clear to me than in conferences with my younger students about their writing. Look here, I say, in this paragraph you have said one thing, and in that you have said the opposite. Which is it to be? They are polite and wish to please, but they are as baffled by the question as I am by the response. I know, they will say, but that is there, and this is here. The difference between us is that I assume there and here, now and then, one paragraph and the next, to be connected, to be continuous, to be part of the same coherent world of thought. That is the way of typographic discourse, and typography is the universe I'm coming from, as they say. But they are coming from a different universe of discourse altogether, the now-this world of television. The fundamental assumption of that world is not coherence, but discontinuity. And in a world of discontinuities, contradiction is useless as a test of truth or merit, because contradiction does not exist. My point is that we are by now so thoroughly adjusted to the now-this world of news, a world of fragments where events stand alone, stripped of any connection to the past or to the future or to other events, that all assumptions of coherence have vanished. And so, perforce, has contradiction. In the context of no context, so to speak, it simply disappears. And in its absence, what possible interest could there be in a list of what the president says now and what he said then? It is merely a rehash of old news, and there is nothing interesting or entertaining in that. The only thing to be amused about is the bafflement of reporters at the public's indifference. There is an irony in the fact that the very group that has taken the world apart should, on trying to piece it together again, be surprised that no one notices much or cares. For all his perspicacity, George Orwell would have been stymied by this situation. There is nothing Orwellian about it. The president does not have the press under his thumb. The New York Times and the Washington Post are not Pravda. The Associated Press is not TASS. And there is no newspeak here. Lies have not been defined as truth, nor truth as lies. All that has happened is that the public has adjusted to incoherence and been amused into indifference. Which is why Aldous Huxley would not in the least be surprised by the story. Indeed, he prophesied its coming. He believed that it is far more likely that the Western democracies will dance and dream themselves into oblivion than march into it single file and manacled. Huxley grasped, as Orwell did not, that it is not necessary to conceal anything from a public insensible to contradiction and narcotized by technological diversions. Although Huxley did not specify that television would be our main line to the drug, he would have no difficulty accepting Robert McNeil's observation that television is the soma of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Big Brother turns out to be Howdy Doody. I do not mean that the trivialization of public information is all accomplished on television. I mean that television is the paradigm for our conception of public information. As the printing press did in an earlier time, television has achieved the power to define the form in which news must come, and it has also defined how we shall respond to it. In presenting news to us packaged as vaudeville, television induces other media to do the same, so that the total information environment begins to mirror television. For example, America's newest and highly successful national newspaper, USA Today, is modeled precisely on the format of television. It is sold on the street in receptacles that look like television sets. Its stories are uncommonly short. Its design leans heavily on pictures, charts, and other graphics, some of them printed in various colors. Its weather maps are a visual delight. Its sports section includes enough pointless statistics to distract a computer. As a consequence, USA Today, which began publication in September 1982, has become the third largest daily in the United States, as of July 1984, according to the Audit Bureau of Circulations, moving quickly to overtake the Daily News and the Wall Street Journal. Journalists of a more traditional bent have criticized it for its superficiality and theatrics, but the paper's editors remain steadfast in their disregard of typographic standards. The paper's editor-in-chief, John Quinn, has said, "We are not up to undertaking projects of the dimensions needed to win prizes. They don't give awards for the best investigative paragraph." Here is an astonishing tribute to the resonance of television's epistemology. In the age of television, the paragraph is becoming the basic unit of news in print media. Moreover, Mr. Quinn need not fret too long about being deprived of awards. As other newspapers join in the transformation, the time cannot be far off when awards will be given for the best investigative sentence. It needs also to be noted here that new and successful magazines such as People and Us are not only examples of television-oriented print media, but have had an extraordinary ricochet effect on television itself. Whereas television taught the magazines that news is nothing but entertainment, the magazines have taught television that nothing but entertainment is news. Television programs such as Entertainment Tonight turn information about entertainers and celebrities into serious cultural content, so that the circle begins to close. Both the form and content of news becomes entertainment. Radio, of course, is the least likely medium to join in the descent into a Huxleyan world of technological narcotics. It is, after all, particularly well-suited to the transmission of rational, complex language. Nonetheless, and even if we disregard radio's captivation by the music industry, we appear to be left with the chilling fact that such language as radio allows us to hear is increasingly primitive, fragmented, and largely aimed at invoking visceral response. Which is to say, it is the linguistic analog to the ubiquitous rock music that is radio's principal source of income. As I write, the trend in call-in shows is for the host to insult callers, whose language does not in itself go much beyond humanoid grunting. Such programs have little content, as this word used to be defined, and are merely of archaeological interest in that they give us a sense of what a dialogue among Neanderthals might have been like. More to the point, the language of radio newscasts has become, under the influence of television, increasingly decontextualized and discontinuous, so that the possibility of anyone's knowing about the world, as against merely knowing of it, is effectively blocked. In New York City, radio station WINS entreats its listeners to give us 22 minutes and we'll give you the world. This is said without irony, and its audience, we may assume, does not regard the slogan as the conception of a disordered mind. And so we move rapidly into an information environment which may rightly be called trivial pursuit. As the game of that name uses facts as a source of amusement, so do our sources of news. It has been demonstrated many times that a culture can survive misinformation and false opinion. It has not yet been demonstrated whether a culture can survive if it takes the measure of the world in 22 minutes, or if the value of its news is determined by the number of laughs it provides.